You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
Hey, folks. We are a couple minutes after 3:30, so let us begin. My name is Jules Polonetsky. I'm the director of the Future of Privacy Forum. My co-chair, Chris Wolf, you see over there in the back. So I am your moderator today, and I will try to get our folks here engaged in a bit of a discussion. Their bios are in packets, and many of you know very well Justin Brookman, who leads the Consumer Privacy Project at CDT. You know Mike Zanis, you know Iwana, and you know Dan, who is at ITIF, all who spend a big chunk of their time worrying about consumer privacy, worrying about what happens on the Hill internationally, and with a particular interest and focus on the technology part of the world. So we're going to jump a little in. This panel probably was initially planned to help brief you on the released White House white paper, Department of Commerce, NTIA report, maybe even also the FTC framework for privacy in the future. As those of you who are following this closely, neither of those has yet to be released, but they're, we're all told, imminent, some more imminent than others. But I think many of us have a bit of an idea of what's coming or what ought to be coming in those reports. So we'll talk a little bit about how we see those playing out. We'll touch a little bit on the FTC framework and maybe even some on how some of the FTC's enforcement and settlements are de facto setting a bit of a structure for what they expect privacy to look like. We'll touch maybe for a minute a little bit on the update to the Kids Online Privacy Protection Act, where we know we'll have a new regulation in some period of time, since the FTC gets to do that under the authority that they already have. And then maybe we'll hear a little bit about where the trade groups are going in advancing self-regulation. So let me start just to the left, and we'll walk this way with just a little brief sort of prognostication on what you expect to see and what you'd like to see, and then we'll circle back to maybe discuss and debate a little.
Okay. So I remember I was sitting here in this exact seat in this exact panel last year, and it was like overflow seating, and there's people standing against the wall, and here we have about a fair number, it's like three quarters full, so a fair number of empty seats, so it kind of like symbolizes, kind of sums up where we are as on privacy. It's still people interested, but maybe not quite the momentum we had last year. And you know, last year the FTC report was out, Department of Commerce report was coming out. And we were hopeful that we would actually have a strong push for consumer privacy legislation. And I thought those reports did a really good job of laying out, both from the consumer side and the business side, why it's a good idea. From the consumer side, the people, as collection and correlation gets easier and easier, people have a lot less control over what they're doing. FTC kind of came out and said, what we're doing so far has absolutely failed. It just has not adequately protected consumers. We need something else. The Department of Commerce came out and said, fully from the business point of view, that consumers really need to have trust in these products, and increasingly we're starting to worry that maybe they don't. And privacy is increasingly a competitiveness issue for the United States, that if we have a chance to be the cloud computing leader, we are the cloud computing leader, we have the chance to be the outsourcing leader for data around the world, the fact that the rest of the world has data protection laws and data protection norms in place, us not so much, can be a competitive disadvantage for us. And it really seemed to us, here's a time when Europe, have to have these really strong data protection principles, but they really aren't entirely sure how to translate. And, 15 years later, they still have not really translated them into practice, fundamentally revisiting what they're trying to do. I hope that this is a chance for the United States to offer guidance, like an alternative, a different way, a third way. It seems we have not really grabbed that apple, and I find that disappointing. But that said, it's going to be a challenging Congress, I think, but I think these issues are not going to go away. So whether it's this Congress or the next, I think we're going to keep pushing for some sort of basic principle, fifth-based approach to a privacy law.
So, Dan, you were on a panel recently talking about the benefits of and the risks, the benefits of self-regulation, and that's been a good part of some of your advocacy and scholarship. Here we are talking about laws, whether it's the administration calling for a law. I think we know that that historic step will be taken, exactly what it looks like, obviously, and how flexible of a multi-stakeholder self-regulatory approach it builds into, but it will be the first time that we have a sitting administration calling for a global comprehensive privacy law. Is that the right step? Is a law going to make a difference to the Europeans? Is that going to slow their progression of sort of very difficult privacy legislation that businesses are complaining about?
Well, I do think we'll see a difference in the approach between Europe and the United States. There's a possibility that the United States might head down a very different trajectory than Europe if they go for kind of stronger privacy regulations. They have the potential of doing the harmonization of the data privacy practices. That'll be very interesting to see how that affects business, because I think looking at the U.S., there's, of course, what I would like, and I can talk about that a lot, and then what I think might happen. Interestingly, I think I'm more optimistic that something will happen than you, even though I don't think it should. I think the areas where we're most likely to see action, if not this Congress, just because I think there's a lot of political issues right now, that it might not get the attention some people would like it to get, but I think soon, would be data breach notification, which I think there's increasingly consensus that should be done, and since it's being done at the state level, there's really a focus now on how do you do it at the federal level so you can do it maybe better. And there'll be, I think, increased debate over how to do that.
So let me jump in. Why doesn't – and by the way, you're all smart people. Most of you are thinking, like, I could have been on that panel. Why is he on that panel? So don't wait till the end here. I was sitting in one of those crowded corners, I think, last year saying the same thing, and it was very crowded. And I think people were saying, well, yeah, we want to debate other things, but data breach. We need data breach. Everyone gets it. We need data breach, 50 states. So why is it that we're – what are the political challenges that are creating an issue with data breach? Why don't we have consensus there? What's holding that up?
Well, I mean, yeah, I think there's a number of issues, but you guys want to jump in on some of this?
I want to jump in.
Sure, I'll jump in real quick because this is one of the issues that I've been working on. So I don't know if you guys have been keeping track, but I think we've had about 8 separate data breach bills introduced this Congress, several in the Senate, several in the House. So there has been a lot of activity on this area. The problem has been, and I can speak for consumer groups, or not for all consumer groups. I can speak for some consumer groups. I think the problem is that a lot of times we already have something at state level, and it's really a problem when you're talking about a federal law that will preempt all these state laws already in place that consumer advocates have worked so hard for, that have pushed for, have finally gotten them to pass, and now you're talking about a federal law that's going to preempt those laws. If you do that, you better make sure that that federal law is strong. And I think the problem that we've had so far is that the options, a lot of the options that we've seen on the table have simply just not been strong enough to satisfy what we'd like for consumers from a data breach perspective.
And I might just add, I think a little bit of history here is important on data breach, because when I first started working on data breach notification 8 years ago, when the Choice Point breach happened, and that was kind of the central galvanizing point, I think what we had was we had the advocates actually coming and asking for a federal law immediately. And the business community wasn't ready to come to the table, and we didn't want to react to just one or two breaches, and then as they continue to mount. And I think the advocates played a pretty smart game plan, and they went to the states and they started passing breach notification laws. But even then, the first round, after a couple of years, the first round of laws were not so onerous on business that business was ready to come and ask in Washington, D.C. for a law. But at some point, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, once the states started revisiting their first round of breach laws, there was sort of an inflection point. And you started to get some states that had really burdensome requirements. They went beyond just notification. And so once that happened, I think there was a window there where you had an opportunity probably where in consumer, the consumer groups, the privacy advocates, and the business community probably could have come together. Now they've kind of gone their separate way with industry wanting that preemption. And I think a lot of the advocates just aren't there yet. It's tough.
Well, like many of you, I probably got that Zappos notification saying, don't worry, our financial stuff wasn't stolen, but if your password at our site is the same as your bank password, you might change it. And I'm thinking, I don't remember. I think I maybe once bought something on Zappos. My wife loves it. So I said, oh, check it out. I said, well, I'll go log in, and I'll use the password that I think is my, you know, bank password, and if it is, then I'll go change it. But they had changed it to protect me because those were the passwords that were hacked. So I couldn't figure out. So I went back and I changed my bank password, maybe to what I'm using on Zappos. And I'm a technology expert doing this for 10 years, chief privacy officer and former consumer affairs commissioner. I'm not the smartest person on time, but we've done this here long enough that clearly consumers need a little more help if we can't, you know, figure this out in an easy way. Well, so Mike, let me ask you this. Industry wasn't ready at the time when the initial proposal for federal data breach came up. So one of the things that folks who are watching the Commerce White House plan, as many of you know, some maybe not as deep in the weeds, the Commerce White House report is going to call for a privacy bill of rights, a general high-level piece of privacy legislation with principles around some of the important fair information practices and how to maybe interpret them in a practical way for a Western culture. But it's going to leave a framework to be filled in by multi-stakeholder groups who will convene, perhaps with a direction from Commerce or some manner of convening, and hash out in the room an agreement. And then once companies commit to that and the FTC believes it's an effective bar, it becomes a safe harbor and it's enforceable because people commit to it and the FTC can take action against it. So let's assume that that's actually what the report looks like, as the green paper was and as I think people expect. Do you see industry lining up to find different areas where they'd like to create a self-regulatory but yet legally enforceable structure? To some degree, you've been working on a stakeholder-driven ICON behavioral OBA program. What's your take on how industry is going to react when the administration says, convene?
Well, a couple of high-level points about the, at least from the green paper, that were takeaways, and the idea that we should have greater compatibility of our laws globally, I think makes a lot of sense. I think having a privacy policy office at Commerce makes a lot of sense so that we're thinking about this, these important issues strategically going forward. So I think there's more to the administration, their position that they're developing than just, you know, a self-regulatory program or a consumer privacy bill of rights. But obviously that's going to get a lot of the headlines. So let's assume that we had some sort of underlying, I don't even think we have to assume that there's an underlying law, because that's a really heavy, heavy lift to pass something like a FIPS-style law. But let's assume that we were to convene self-regulatory groups. And we have a model of success in the online behavioral advertising world. What the industry did to bring together literally over 5,000 companies through the Digital Advertising Alliance, through leading trade associations like IAB and the Direct Marketing Association and the Association of National Advertisers and the ad agencies and others, to bring the entire ecosystem and the entire supply chain together that is collecting or using data to come up with a new set of standards for transparency, control, and also enforceability, accountability, is really, I think, a model that we should look to for future success as well. I think it's something that the administration can make as a foundation for, if this is really the approach they want to take going forward, then they can they have this track record of immediate success, and you can build off of that. And I think there's an opportunity to build off of that in other areas. Just the last example is with the DAA. We're currently drafting a set of mobile privacy principles for the mobile platform. And so we will be coming out with something in the coming months in that area. So the key is that industry's not waiting for Congress to pass some underlying law. Industry is innovating in the area of consumer privacy, and that's really, I think, what everybody should be looking to do, is to affect some positive change for the consumer.
Now, the one area where, I guess, multi-stakeholder in the commerce framework goes a bit broader, now with all due giant respect to what it takes to get many thousands of companies, let alone having Iwana and loud, noisy advocates in the room disrupting things before you have it, you know, nailed down. So appreciating the challenge of that process, it appears that multi-stakeholder means some of those noisy advocates get some sort of table or place in the room. So my question to Iwana is, do you show up to a multi-stakeholder process? Do you have to have a veto before you'll show up and give it credibility? And Mike, is there a place for, and obviously you interacted with a lot of folks in the FTC and many, many stakeholders, but is there a place for multi-stakeholder? And Iwana, if you were invited, will you show up and compromise?
I can definitely speak for us, for Consumers Union. We have put this in our comments that we submitted to the Green Paper. We are very happy. We are willing and looking forward to working through this multi-stakeholder process. Of course, we want to make sure that certain parameters are put in place in order to make this a very fair and balanced process. We can't have, you know, a consensus process where all of industry agrees and consumers disagree, and that's sort of the consensus process. There have to be principles put in place to govern the process that goes on during these convenings. And, you know, of course, we want to have our voice heard. We want to be able to submit our concerns, our worries to the table, and we want those concerns to be taken into account and then resolved in a way that's hopefully mutually beneficial for both of us. So, yes, I mean, I can't speak for a lot of other groups, but I know we are certainly willing to work with this process because it's what we have. It's what we have on the table right now. And so we would certainly much rather have a seat at the table than be on the
outside. I'm told that in the ICANN process, people hum to indicate consensus, and at Occupy DC, there's something with some sort of hand motions or something. Is that how it goes, like that? So it sounds like the first challenge may be actually figuring out what that process is.
Sure.
Is it that industry works something out and takes input? Is it, Mike, what's your thinking?
Of course, the advocates are should always have a seat at the table. I don't think there's going to be one single table. I think this notion of, you know, seating everybody around a big, you know, square UN table and hashing it out is probably not that realistic. I mean, some of us are frankly suffering through that process with the World Wide Web Consortium right now, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. I think you have to be flexible enough. When we were putting together our self-regulatory program, we took tremendous input from different groups. You know, CDT was one of the very first groups that actually came up with the idea. I always tease Ari Schwartz that, you know, he was the one that planted the seed of industry self-regulating and the fact that this could actually happen. And I actually give him a lot of credit for that. So we took a lot of input from the Federal Trade Commission, CDT, and some others. So it wasn't sort of unilateral with business. So everybody has to have some inputs.
Yeah, but I mean, I just want to push back a little bit about what we call it, the history of success with the self-regulatory program, right? I mean, like in the 90s, the self-regulatory response to online privacy issues was the development of privacy policies, right? And did that really fix things? Did that really help people at the margins a little bit? Early 2000s, end of the 1990s, NAIA comes forward as a way to govern self-regulation for advertising. 8 years, not a lot really achieved, right? I mean, some value, but not a lot. Now there's been a lot of legislative tension, which has really pushed DAA to do more of the right thing. But I think we would push back at the idea that what you've come to is really sufficient, right? I mean, you have the ICON project, which I give you guys a lot of credit for doing that. I think it helps a lot, but still talking to anyone outside of D.C., they know what the ICON project is. No one has any idea what I'm talking about, right? I mean, anyone I've talked to, I've not seen one person in the industry understand what the ICON does or what it means, and I think Jules has said all along, for this program to be successful, you really need to do meaningful user education, and I don't think we've seen it yet. Similarly, I think DAA has done a great job on limiting the uses of data. So the revised DAA principles that came out end of last year, I think, were good. But I think from CDT's and certainly I think the rest of the advocates' perspective, probably not sufficient. Still allows for pretty much unfettered collection, right? I mean, like you have to have like a reason for it, and then once you have it, you can keep it forever. Progress, but I think not there, which is why we're, I think, supportive of the multi-stakeholder approach. It can't just be, you know, here we'll develop the principles ourselves and then bring in advocates at the end, they can complain or not. I don't think we need a veto, but I think having a more systematic input process, I think it is needed here.
Could we just a couple of points, counterpoints of clarification, really, is I think we kind of do ourselves a disservice if we just call it the ICON project. ICONs are a big part of it, and if you haven't seen it, I don't have an example, but it's what we call the forward I. It's basically a triangle, looks like a play button with a lowercase I in it. It today, as of December, I think my numbers are from, that icon is appearing in 1 trillion, that's trillion with a T, ads every single day in the United States alone. And so it's about transparency. It's not about the icon, I agree. I mean, I don't think the icon in and of itself is what we meant to build. What we meant to build was increased transparency. I think consumers can understand what that icon and associated wording means. And then that they can easily learn more about how data is being collected, and they have a simple-to-use choice option. One click, you opt out of all. And I do beg to differ. I think, if you look last year in 2011, over 1 million Americans opted out of the DAA choice page or the NAI page. So to say that consumers don't understand it or they're not utilizing it is actually wrong. And I think Jules did some research before we ever launched the icon that demonstrated consumers actually do understand what this icon means to a general degree. They understand it. It's about how information is being used for advertising purposes. And I think you gloss over the most important part, which is accountability, which is the fact that we have the Council of Better Business Bureaus with an enforcement program that is up and running, that has already brought half a dozen cases, that at the end of the day, bringing companies into compliance and identifying the companies that are not within these new principles is really what's probably most powerful about the program. And we can talk about, listen, we've never raised the flag and said, mission accomplished. We need to continue. We need to push out. And the collection document that you referenced was a future iteration, right? We put out our principles a couple of years ago. We operationalized them. Then we said, the next step is, let's stop. If a consumer has chosen not to be tracked, to opt out, then let's not have people collecting that data, unless it's fundamentally important for things like market research, product development, or web analytics. And that's really the key. And we won't stop there. And we won't stop with consumer education. We will continue that as well.
Before we move from behavioral advertising, because I've talked about it for 10 years, and I'm thinking probably after this year, I just don't want to ever hear about it again, as some of you have. But before we move on to behavioral advertising, the one piece of the program that I think hasn't gotten a lot of attention, which maybe is more important than icons or other things, the concerns that critics throw out when they talk about what they're worried about with behavioral advertising are usually, is the data going to be used not just to give me a better ad or a creepier ad or a different ad, it's who else is going to have it and is it going to be used to hurt me or discriminate against me? And there was an update that didn't get a ton of attention. You mentioned it, and I wonder whether you would just say a little bit more about the principles, the guidance, what it is that came out more recently that said companies that participate shouldn't do these sorts of things with the data.
Yeah, absolutely. And let me make another point then. Accountability is so important, right? Any self-regulatory program is only as strong as the enforcement mechanism. And so if you look at the Direct Marketing Association and the IAB, we require, through our membership codes and all of our member companies, it's over 3,000 member companies, must participate and in this program, must follow these principles. So that's really key. What we introduced in the fall of last year was this collection document, which, amongst other things, increased the scope of the program. So it wasn't just about how data was being used. It was also about not collecting data in certain instances. And then you're right, the last part of that document was around sensitive data. And so we know that consumers are really concerned about what we call eligibility categories, things that could actually, hurt your well-being. Is data being collected about you so that you can't get insurance or a job or credit? And so we just took all of those off the table. Not that the industry is using this data for those purposes. I've never seen any proof, any company actually doing it, but we figured we ought to just take it off the table because we as an industry shouldn't be collecting things like your web browsing behavior and selling it to your insurance company so that your rates go up. That's not something the advertising industry wants to do, so we took it off the table.
Well, I'm glad it was taken off the table. There was one company that, when I spoke to them, they said, well, we actually never found someone who was interested in this product. But they did create a product that took a look at who your friends were, and they determined that if your friends were deadbeats or poor credit risks, you probably aren't either. Now, I guess there's some statistics there, but I just don't want to have to judge the next friend request based on, well, how well do I know you, or and by the way, are you going to hurt my credit rating if I accept my friendship? They claim they actually never launched it, and they were puffing, you know, about it. But it sounds like hopefully that sort of thing, you know, might be off the table.
Well, this panel is about legislation, right? And a terrible idea is to take hypothetical or products that are not in the marketplace or to legislate in the realm of the possible, not the actual. And so to take an example of that as somebody who was maybe looking into it, maybe we could do something like this. Maybe there would be a product here. And then to vilify the industry is certainly not the right approach, certainly not what Congress should be doing. They should be looking at actual bad actions or really probable future bad results for consumers before they really take seriously legislation or somebody like the FTC looks at regulation.
Right, but I mean, that's not the only concern that people had about digital advertising, right? I mean, companies collecting cross-site data about me, you know, whether it's just for no reason whatsoever, for market research, right? I mean, market research, cross-site market research is something that traditionally has been done on an opt-in basis. I think it's something like Nielsen, right? I think all these companies can create profiles about where it could be Justin, right? It could be where I go. All across the internet, that could be accessed by government, right? And your principals don't do anything about that. It could be breached to the public. Your principals don't do anything about that. So I think, I mean, backing up, I do give you guys a lot of credit for limiting, okay, we're not going to use it for these bad purposes. It doesn't solve all of advocates' problems.
Well, I want to... Behavioral advertising has eaten all privacy issues. We cannot talk about anything else on any panel ever. So let's hold for a second on behavioral advertising. Let's go to the Dan and Ioana on something other, because industry's done a lot of work. We're waiting to see perhaps whether in the FTC report there's support and applause and recognition of that. It sounds like they've said favorable things, but this will be perhaps the formal recognition that they do think there needs to be a law or they don't think there needs to be a law. So let's hold off until perhaps we actually see an FTC document coming out sometime following Commerce.
My comments about it kind of more broadly.
More broad.
So, you know, just to kind of respond to what you said, Justin, I think there's this criticism of self-regulation versus government regulation. And it is one more effective than another. And that's an issue I'm particularly interested in. Mike's talked about how, what they've done in this sector over time and how that's changed. And, you've criticized how it's played out in the past, but we have seen a lot of change. And I just bring that up because, you also bring up government privacy. And I think that is an issue that a lot of people have concern about, how government uses data. And when you look at, kind of the number one law there, ECPA, that hasn't changed in over 30 years. So if you kind of compare the two models, on that basis, it looks like, self-regulation actually gives you this kind of more flexibility when you talk about how you can regulate privacy.
So let's talk for a second about the one regulation that we know we are getting, no matter what the legislative process, the update that the FTC is doing to the Kids Privacy Act. What did you like and what didn't you like? And let me start with Ioana and then quickly just go around. Give me one thing you liked and one thing you didn't like.
Okay. One thing we liked was the fact that IP addresses are now being included in, I guess, personally identifiable information under COPPA. So right now, before, the way this regulation was understood was if you were collecting names and, specific addresses and all that that specifically identified a child, that would be covered by COPPA. But if you were simply collecting information about the user's device, like the IP address, but it didn't actually identify the child, it identified their device, then that was okay. And I think the FTC has now said that if you're identifying their device, that's also a way to communicate with a child. That's also a way to reach out to a child. And so that is covered by COPPA.
So when in my comments, in the Future Privacy Forum comments, and in certainly comments that I think others may have echoed, we said we get that behavioral advertising to kids, mm-hmm. not a good idea. Not really aware of companies doing it. If anybody is, they shouldn't, again, without parental consent of some sort, if someone can figure out how to do that. The FTC language, however, goes a bit more broadly. It says, an IP, it says a cookie, it's anything logged across sites. So would you be comfortable if when they tweak based on the input, they say, well, we don't really want to break analytics. We don't want that behavioral advertising. Kids can't understand that. It's too intrusive a method of advertising for them. But are we comfortable with analytics? And are we comfortable with, let's say, Disney buys ads on six different kids' websites, and nobody's given anybody names or anything like that. And then they want to know, are the ads on kids site one the ones users are clicking on, or kids site two, because they want to buy smart? Or maybe it's the federal government trying to do a campaign advising kids not to do drugs, and they want to know which ads. They're paying a lot of money for those AOL ads. Maybe they're better off with the Facebook ads. No users individually targeted or tracked, but they're going to get a report such as the one that most ad servers provide. Is there room to nuance that?
I think there's room to nuance. I think analytics, depending on how it's done, there's an area there where we can say that's fine. You're just collecting information about how many people clicked, how many people chose this ad over this ad. I think that's fine. I think that the problem here is once you have someone's IP address, you can identify that device, and now you are tracking that device across websites. You're seeing what that particular device is clicking on, what are they interested in, and then based on that, you are taking action X, whether it's to use targeted advertisement, whether it's to sell that information for other purposes. I think that's the concern that we have here.
Great. Let's go to Mike and then come back.
Sure. It's a good question. I actually think that this is probably the most important issue facing industry this year, is the fact that, as Jules pointed out, we are going to have most likely this year a new rule under COPPA. And the FTC, although nothing certain, it was a proposed rule, certainly put kind of threw a lot against the wall. And there's some to like and some to have some concerns with. We certainly like the fact that they preserve the actual knowledge standard underlying COPPA and the age standard, which I think is the right approach. I think we just kind of have some specific concerns, but my one is kind of a high level at the aggregate, the changes to the definitions and what is personal information, and sort of encompassing all unique identifiers, which could be things just like a city and a street on a mobile device, perhaps the unique device identifier, which is often used for certain purposes, could begin to really regulate all things like analytics and not just the concerns that we have, rightfully so, in protecting children online.
Great. Justin, Dan?
I mean, I think I mostly agree with what everyone said so far. I like retaining the actual knowledge standard. I like keeping the age where it was. I think you guys have drilled down. I think I agree with Awana that there are privacy issues for pseudonymous identifiers. But I also agree with Mike and Jules that the report didn't drill down to that as well. It could have left a lot of uncertainty. Fortunately, I think a lot of the comments from consumer groups and industry all said the same thing. So I'm confident we'll get it right in the end.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. I think the emphasis on extending the definition to include persistent identifiers and geolocation will have an impact on the kind of larger privacy debate as well. And I think these are kind of hot issues now. I think we're going to see biometrics and some other issues become hot, like geolocation and submission for this past year.
Iwana, were you folks okay with leaving the age at 13?
Yeah, we were okay with that. We thought 13 was appropriate for what COP is meant to do, but at the same time, in our comments, we mentioned we want heightened protections for teens. Now, whether we don't think that the appropriate standard here is parental consent, but I think a lot of times it's important to recognize that teens do process information differently from adults. They may not understand the consequences of what they're giving away when, let's say, they're getting a free service that actually collects information about them. And so while we were okay with COPPA keeping the age at 13, we would like to see additional heightened protections for teens. We're not sure what that would look like, but we would like to see that.
Let's talk about apps just for a second. Apps, obviously, one of the exciting things that we've seen in the past 2 years. Thousands and thousands and thousands of app developers. We did a survey, which we do every 6 months, taking a look at how and if app developers are putting up privacy policies. Not that those are the solution to anything, but it shows that you've actually done some work to figure something out and that you've put yourself on the hook for your practices. So let's start there and maybe then figure out what additional things they ought to do. And it's no surprise, as in the early days of the web, few websites had privacy policies. It took time, and now it's ubiquitous. Today, 20 to 30% of the apps that we survey have a privacy policy. Now, that doesn't mean some of them don't tell you what you do, right? We didn't test every single app. Some of them may actually say, hey, give us this data. Here's what we're going to do with it. But they didn't have a formal policy, which is something that we were testing. The interesting thing that we did find, though, is that free apps were twice as likely to have a privacy policy as the paid apps, which initially is a little bit counterintuitive because you figure, well, the paid guys, or that's the bigger companies that are getting money for their app, and the other folks are getting money, but it's ad-supported, it's probably less. But presumably what we are seeing is that those are actually ad-supported, or they're earning revenue based on referring a download of another app, and they're using one sort of tracking device or another, and it appears they seem to be more likely, despite perhaps less resources, to be doing something or be asked to do something by their ad network or by the platforms to actually put privacy policies in place. Do we have to do anything different? Is an app just another piece of software that happens to live on a program? Do we leave this alone because it's new and it's growing? Do we have a problem? Many apps are getting location. It seems like that's driven some of the interest on the Hill and some of the committees. Is there a problem with location that the Hill needs to look at, either generally or with regard to apps? And if so, who is it that... Is it the apps? Is it at one point it seemed like the people who had location were the carriers, and certainly they have location services, but today it seems that it's the device and the OS and the app developer that are getting it directly from GPS, directly from Wi-Fi router databases. So thoughts from any of you on apps or some of the other kind of new technologies that we're seeing that are getting a lot of attention? Is it time for a Hill response? Start at the left.
Argued that no, we wouldn't necessarily prefer a mobile-only or location-only law. We are actually supportive of the Franken geolocation privacy bill as well as the Wyden one. I still think it's best to deal with these as a whole cloth, right? I mean, the technology may be very different in 10 years. I don't think we need a mobile-only privacy bill. That said, there are heightened issues with mobile applications. I mean, they are more likely to be tied to unique device identifiers. That's not a cookie that you can just delete when you're using an app to make Angry Birds forget about who you are. It's tied to your phone's identifier, or it's a lot easier to fingerprint your phone. They do collect location, which, you know, collected over time is going to be intrinsically identifying, right? I mean, if Angry Birds knows where I am at 9 p.m. and know where I am at 2 p.m., they know who I am, right? So it's a lot easier for companies to keep track of who you are. And it's a lot easier to tie it to other information, right? Mobile devices are designed to expose information in ways that your home computers just aren't. And on the flip side, we're seeing less... maybe less developed, but we don't see the results of self-regulation in this area at all, right? We don't see the ICON project. There's no way to find out about it online. There's no global opt-out for behavioral advertising on my phone. Maybe there will be in 3 years. Is that sufficient? I would argue not. I'd like to see faster movement in this area, but I mean, this kind of highlights the problem that, without basic privacy protections in place, industry can kind of skirt by for a while, and consumers have no way of really figuring out what's happening with information online.
Mike, is it a few years? You said something about DAA advancing on mobile. I noticed the other day that the Better Business Bureau's group that was set up to do the enforcement over online behavioral advertising is now called Online and Mobile. What more can you tell folks about how mobile may be addressed in the near term?
Yeah, I mean, since I've been at IAB for 5 years, next year is going to be the year of mobile. So I do think we're actually reaching that point, mobile marketing, depending on how you count it, $1 billion last year. So it is growing. That being said, you can't put the cart before the horse and self-regulate a program for a marketplace that doesn't really exist. So is it a few years? No, I don't think it's a few years. I think that the market is now finally developed to the extent that we actually know who the players are. A year ago, we didn't have a panel on mobile privacy because we didn't know who all the players were. And, is it the carriers? Is it the operating system? Is it the hardware manufacturer? Is it the mobile ad network? Is it the app itself? It's coming. And so mobile self-regulation, mobile privacy self-regulation is coming this year. That I'm very sure of, just as the marketplace is finally developing. So I don't think we're skirting by. I think we're actually being very proactive. I mean, you know, we were criticized with NAI from 98 and not doing anything for 10 years. It's kind of hard to criticize us for not having a mobile self-reg program stood up today when we're working very hard, and we will have one very soon. I think that's key. But I can tell you a self-reg program will get stood up much faster than any legislation can be created or codified. The reality is, if we were having this discussion, we just waved a magic legislative wand, who would you put all the liabilities on? You'd probably just stick it on the app developers, right? Because it's just, who do you think? Well, the app developer gets this information, so they must have obligations. But you could pass a law tomorrow. It doesn't mean you're going to have 100,000 app developers in compliance. It wouldn't be effective. So I would argue we should actually learn from the industry. And we should actually figure out how, when you bring the entire supply chain together and you figure out where the choke points are and where the actual opportunities are, because in the mobile space, there are unique challenges, right? We've talked about location. We talk about things like UDIDs. Those are challenges. But there's always a corresponding opportunity, which means when you have your smartphone, right? This is very intimate to me, more so than my laptop. And so every time I download an app, I'm engaging with that app. There's an opportunity to teach and to communicate. And every time when I first buy my device, you have to turn on location. So there's an opportunity to engage with the consumer and to teach. And there's always an ongoing opportunity for them to exercise choice as well. So we agree. Listen, mobile data, location data is more sensitive than online browsing data. There's no question about that. But we also need to have certain practices that then cover just mobile browsing, then maybe don't include location. So it's not as simple as saying opt in, opt out. You need to actually understand the marketplace.
So 30 seconds for those of you who said UDID, who do you want? What is he talking about there? So ready, quick. In the web world, cookies are the trackable thing. We talk a lot about IP addresses, but it's generally the cookie, a number that most browsers will let an ad network or an analytics company in the background when you visit a site, as your browser goes to those services, logs that number, and helps, therefore, keep track of what your browser is doing across sites, maybe just for analytics, maybe for ad reporting, maybe for behavioral, depending on what's going on. In the mobile world, the Android browser does support cookies. The Safari browser, and again, in the desktop world, Safari automatically doesn't permit third-party cookies, the kind that allow tracking across sites by default. Not a huge deal, because Safari has still relatively small market share in the desktop world. Safari has huge percent of the actual browsing activity online. You iPhone people are wasting all your time browsing, and consume a huge amount of data and spend a lot of time browsing. And those cookies, therefore, are not available for many of those mobile browsers, number one. Number two, the apps of the world don't support cookies, the little built-in browser that exists when you visit an app and it goes and pings itself to allow some sort of tracking with an analytics company or an ad and so forth. There isn't a place that enables that. And so what those third parties do, since they don't have a cookie and they need some way to count how many times they've delivered an ad or how many users have downloaded the app, is they grab what is available. And what is available might be something called a UDID, which is an Apple term for the ID that the iOS and the iPhone devices have. There's a similar one on the Android side of the world. The Android, despite the Android browser supporting cookies, the Android marketplace, the Android apps don't. And so the third parties of the world grabbed what they could. There was a big story, what they know, the industry was well aware, that's what they were using, but it became a big expose because not everybody understood, and the accusation was, wait, these are worse than cookies, they're more fixed. And the third party said, okay, give us something else. Apple, Android, we're more than happy to give us a cookie. Give us something that users can turn off. Today, it's very hard to opt out of those. You can, but you've got to go through some kludgier processes. And so that's sort of where we are in the mobile world. So I was at CES last week, like some of you, and I figured, okay, the industry is thinking about how to do mobile and bring some of the same thinking from the behavioral and the tracking to the mobile world with the limitations of small devices and different kinds of tracking processes, and so the challenges of opting out and so forth. And I was looking at the smart home devices and the smart grid devices that were tying together refrigerators and TVs and stoves. There was a wonderful refrigerator which, if I scanned my receipts, kept track of them, and then at a supermarket, instead of calling my wife and saying, what do we need? What did you say? I can't find the list. I would log into my refrigerator, and it would also set it against any dietary restrictions, any allergies, and so forth. Sounded really cool, and I'm just thinking that next year we're going to have this panel, and people are going to be saying, Mike, what are you guys doing about a program for the smart refrigerators and the smart devices and the smart grid? So I think we obviously are going to continue chasing the new technologies and maybe hopefully having a framework that we can continue to plug in instead of starting some of these things from scratch.
That's why you need a principles-based solution instead of a technology-based solution, which is the approach we've taken.
Totally agree.
Hey, Juana, what's your big wish for the year? Is it that there be legislation? Is it that location gets dealt with? Maybe talk about kids for a second outside the kids online. You're looking at the leader of FOSSI here, and he wants us to talk a little bit more about kids. Do we need do not track for kids? Do we need kids delete themselves from the internet, or their parents delete them if they don't like what the kids are saying or doing? What are you worrying about when it comes to kids?
I think there are a lot of concerns about kids, and I think that's at least one area where a lot of people are coming together and saying, yes, this is an area of more concern than maybe adults. And so we would definitely love to see a do not track option that is implemented widely for everyone. If not, we would like to see at least a do not track for kids, at least a way for kids to be completely opted out of behavioral marketing and that type of targeting. I'm not sure about programs that allow kids to erase themselves. I mean, if you posted the information up there, you certainly should be able to take it down completely, and it should not be stored somewhere in the company's servers to resurface at some point. But I think the problem that you run into there is, what if someone else copies that information, posted on their site? Do you want to make it mandatory for that person to then also have to take that information down? So I think you run into some serious problems there that really need to be worked out.
What about your parents? I mean, if I'm 16, should my parents be able to tell Facebook, I don't like that my kid is talking about his emerging sexuality or his politics or his drinking or whatever it is?
I think that's a really difficult question. I think you run into some serious First Amendment issues there. I don't think for teens we would advocate a parental consent model or parental requirement model, maybe for children under 13 in the COPPA model, but definitely for teens we would like to have, as I was mentioning before, some sort of heightened protections that maybe give more information to the teen themselves and let them make decisions based on that information, but I don't think a parental approval model there would probably work.
Stephen, what do you have to say about this?
Thank you, Jules. Just to be clear, we're not backing the Do Not Track Kids Act for different reasons, but I want to go back to COPPA for a moment, and I just wonder if anyone on the panel saw Dana Boyd's research that came out, I think it was towards the early November of last year, where she looked at the issue of underage kids on social networking sites and tested this notion of the under 13 rule of COPPA. A lot of parents in her study, it was a field study, thought that it was a bit like the PG-13 advice given by the MPAA. That was number one. The second unintended consequence that she saw with COPPA was that a lot of 10, 11, and 12-year-olds were lying to get onto Facebook and other social networking sites and putting their ages as 21, 25, 30. And because of that, they didn't get the default setting of greater protection that they do have now for teens. So I'd just be curious to get your thoughts about that age issue and the third, because when you guys talked about 30, everyone seemed to be comfortable with that. And I'm just wondering if you'd seen Dana's research and what your thoughts were.
Sure, I can respond. I did see the research. I read it very closely. And I think for us, you know, that there will always be problems with networks like that where you have to put in your own age in order to get on it. It's sort of, you know, how do you get around that? Kids are going to lie. Kids will always try to get around things. That being said, I'd just like to point out that, for example, with Facebook and probably with other social networks, there is a system in place for them to allow kids under 13 to be on the site. It just has to be done through their parents' consent. So, you know, arguably, if Facebook came up with a program, say, linking children's Facebook accounts with their parents' accounts and then having parents approve what their kids are doing on the site, maybe that would give another option for parents who want their kids to be on the site, but they want to have better monitoring.
So why isn't it happening? Because I flagged that same point, Stephen, to some of the FTC staff, and they said, well, the solution is Facebook and Apple for iTunes and should just create, you know, parental consent models. And I said, well, they all haven't. And clearly they would like to have kids or like to have people who are going to be adults or whatever the reason. There is some market there, and they're all expanding. We're all on Facebook already and all on, you know, all these social networks. The kids are obviously the next frontier. And you actually have child psychologists and parents saying, I want my kid on. It's not black or white. I'd like to get on there. Well, they'll still let me have the password instead of, you know, in a couple of years when they won't. Why aren't companies implementing and what are the barriers? And perhaps that's what the FTC might post this report, take a look at what can be done to eliminate whatever the barriers that are out there today that seem to be keeping companies from figuring out how to create those mechanisms. Let's go to the audience. Let's have Dan, and then let's go to the audience.
I was just to respond to that. I'm not advocating this, but I would say that if there was targeted advertising for children, there'd be more of a market. So that's something to keep in mind.
We would have to change our self-regulatory program, just for the record.
Yes. Who are you, sir?
Oh, yeah, I'll do the normal. Morgan Reed with ACT. So on behalf of the mobile apps developers, I guess it's a good thing to stand up here and say that we are working hard to find self-regulatory solutions, and we are working with folks like the Future of Privacy Forum and privacychoice.org and a whole collection of others, as well as IAB, to get on board. To get our membership on board with doing privacy policies. But one of the really interesting things, and I wanted to get the panel's point on this, was to going to Stephen's point. We've talked to a lot of our developers who do kids' apps and educational apps aimed at children. And what we found when they actually reached out to the parents who were using these apps, these aren't games apps, these are educational apps. These are, I'm going to use my iPad to help my kid learn mathematics. And what they're finding is that parents actually already say that they have consented. That we have a problem right now, a dichotomy that happens, at least for our mobile apps developers, between parental consent, as the parent understands it, and government-approved parental consent. And the government-approved version of parental consent is not moving at the same speed where parents are moving. So all of the time, our developers who are in this very niche area of educational apps aimed at kids under 13, the perfect COPPA target, when they talk to the parents, they say, I know what you're doing. And I can find this information, and I'm part of the process. So we need to find some way, and I'd be interested to say, how do we get what parents feel they're doing to offer consent, handing the device, using restriction screens, and getting that to match up with government-approved parental consent? Because as an industry, that's what we're seeing, a big dichotomy between government-approved and actual parental consent.
I'm going to suggest none of us have the magic answer to that, but that's where I think we all think maybe the FTC might do some multi-stakeholder convening of its own and get us all to do some of the hard work to figure that out. I have a question for Alan Davidson, who is, a free man now, but has spent such a interesting and rewarding and challenging time both building the Google Policy Office for years and during his days at CDT. So a huge amount of knowledge, and now he's not fettered by, right? Are you officially?
I'm still fettered.
He's still fettered. All right. I figured we'd get. I was going
to reserve the right to not answer.
I was going to say now, not burdened by, you know, advocacy conflicts, corporate conflicts. You know, what's the burning solution that you'd like to see us focus on? But given that you are still fettered, I won't put you on that hook. Let me
turn.
Oh, they want to hear, given that you're fettered, but All right. Who's next year? We've got our panelists. Guillermo, you heard folks saying that they want a little more flexibility in the kids' world. Common Sense Media has taken a strong position looking at advanced privacy protections for kids. You want to agree, disagree?
I'm Guillermo Rajki from Common Sense Media. One of the items that we put in our comments was support for the FTC's proposals for having new forms of parental consent come out. So they're going to have a notice and comment process for them. They're going to have the safe harbor providers be able to create their own forms of parental consent. Because the consent is kind of triggers the whole other host of COPPA obligations. So once we do have more parental consent coming through in these apps, then the apps can go ahead and follow the rest of COPPA. So like security requirements, the parental control, the parental deletion rights that COPPA gives, that can all follow once they have the consent.
Great, thank you.
I think that's right. It's interesting that the FTC took some of, like Email Plus and such, suggesting taking that away. We'd like to see more parental consent options, I think. I mean, just to Morgan's point, too, just because I can't pass it up. I mean, I kind of feel like when I've got my Cinderella dress-up application on my iPad for my three-year-old daughter, then I've consented to whatever the data collection is because I actually pay attention to it. But, I mean, I think parents just need more choices and a little more transparency.
Yes, anybody else want to point us in a different direction? No, you're all good. Let me ask you whether anyone thinks that we've all probably opined that we don't expect to see a legislative process come to fruition this year. But are we going to see a change in attitude if the partisan nature of the mix changes? Is this an issue that Dems and Republicans all agree on? Is this an issue that we'll see Republicans talking about jobs and the economy? And will the elections matter at all when it comes to privacy?
I think you're going to see Democrats. I think you're going to see Republicans and Democrats talking about jobs. I mean, it's an election year, and that's not going to go away. So I think innovation, job creation is top of mind for everybody. And I think right now, at least in the foreseeable future, I think the action legislatively is over in Europe. I think that's the real place to look and see how the countries codify the directive.
So let's touch, before we take the question, let's touch Europe for a second. People who are following this closely saw the draft, presumed draft, EU regulation, which different than other previous EU efforts, actually becomes directly applicable as a regulation as opposed to being a action that each country has to implement within a certain time frame. So a little more real than, or a little more immediate. Is anything that the administration or the FTC or industry does with regard to U.S. practices going to make a difference to the Europeans? And is what they're proposing actually going to be so challenging that it has a real dramatic effect? There is language in there talking about penalties that are 5% of a company's worldwide revenue, which I guess that's billions and billions of dollars for some companies. Justin, as CDT is active globally and you're on many of the international panels, is there some good in any of those proposals? Is it going to stifle innovation? Is it protectionist to make it more difficult for U.S. cloud companies to do business? What's your take?
I mean, we've always supported the principle behind the European Data Protection Directive. We've always seen that the implementation of it has been terribly problematic, and in many cases it's just not there. I think that there are things we liked in the draft legislation, but I mean I think we've seen that given that four of the DGs came out, the internal process within Europe for the other cabinet groups to kind of look at the legislation, it was kind of unprecedentedly strong negative reaction from a lot of them about some of these things like the penalties, like the right to be forgotten, like the rapid data breach notification elements. A lot of things in there, I think, were problematic. And I think they would be open to guidance. And I think that's why we've long argued U.S. should offer some sort of alternative to engage. We've long argued for interoperability. But interoperability with what? We haven't offered anything other than self-regulation to interoperate with. I think we have a chance now, the next 2 to 4 years, to try to put something in place that, as an alternative means, and I think they definitely are open to it, given that they've recognized what they've done hasn't protected consumers adequately, and that what their first iteration of what might do it probably won't do it either.
Yes, we're close to time. Let's take the question.
Carl Zabo with NetChoice. Just to respond on that last point about the EU, we at NetChoice did an analysis. If the U.S. did an EU-style opt-in method for behavioral advertising, it would cost U.S. businesses $33 billion over 5 years. But now,
$33 billion, yeah.
No, $33 billion. This was based off an MIT study. Anyways, getting back to the point, if it sounds like, based on what Jules has said, that we may not be seeing legislation finalized this year, may take a while, doesn't it behoove groups like Consumer Union to educate its members about programs like the advertising icon, rather than let the perfect be the enemy of the good? Isn't it better to educate consumers on how best to control their privacy with the tools that they have accessible to them today?
I don't think Consumers Union has ever been on this area in the position where the perfect is the enemy of good. We have tried to work with a lot of the proposal that were put on the table, and I agree with you, and we are already educating our consumers about browser add-ons, about extensions that they can download, about things that they can do to control how their data is collected and disseminated at this point. I think the reason that we're not necessarily going full out on the IAB ICOM program is because, echoing what my colleague Justin said, while we think it's a great step forward, there's still the problem that when you're opting out, you are not opting out of collection of information. You're mainly opting out of seeing targeted ads. And so we are concerned that the consumers that are using this program, if we advise them to, will get the wrong idea about what exactly it's doing. So we are. I don't want to downplay the program. I think it's a great step forward. We want to work with you. We want to continue pushing it to a great level. At the same time, we have concerns that it's not quite there yet and that consumers aren't fully understanding what it is that they're opting out when they're using the ICOM program.
You see, we come back to behavioral advertising no matter what the privacy issue is. So let's close.
Can I answer your previous question very quickly? I know we're running out of time. I think the thing that is going to have impact on the EU is the fact that this administration can go over to Europe and they can get online and they can demonstrate that today the American consumer has greater protections in this area, more transparency, more control, an enforceable program, whereas in Europe they don't have that. They have a law with no enforcement. And so I think that the proof is really in the pudding here in the U.S., and I think that's a really strong talking point for this administration to go over and have discussions about what can and cannot work, about how you can have self-regulation here, which does give consumers transparency and control over how data is collected and not just used. I think that's really powerful for these folks.
Let me just close with that note, because I do think that the challenge that we have when we show up internationally and we say self-regulation, it sounds to the ear of a local European like someone showing up here and saying, we don't need laws that protect, you know, women and minorities and folks against discrimination, because companies will do it right. So I think that the challenge is when one shows up and says, yes, we recognize that privacy is the right. No, the way to do it is not to be super prescriptive, because then you end up creating more harm than good and sort of a muddle, but you at least come to the table with the view that, yes, we care about privacy too, we care about law too, but here's how law can bridge and be implemented in a flexible way. Well, let me close with a positive note. We try to keep a gallery of leading practices on our site, because we do spend, and we all spend a lot of time complaining about this company and that company, and it's nice to give a carrot when folks do something useful. And so I think in terms of consumer education, I haven't seen the campaign yet. I don't know if any of you did, but I think Google launched a big campaign today called Good to Know that seeks to explain how data is used online, with millions and millions of dollars of TV and print and major publications. And targeted ads too. Many of you who are following the campaigns have noticed, and certainly we saw this during the last campaign, but I'm already seeing more targeting from the candidates running for national office using data that they see on a Facebook profile, data that is available through behavioral. And it'll be interesting to see as this sort of new method, not new to the industry, but still small when it comes to the political side of the market, starts becoming a more significant part of what candidates do and how folks spend money, whether that ends up in any way tailoring any of the understanding. We shall see. I'm supposed to tell you that there is a cocktail party or other networking thing that follows this, and to remind you that there is an exciting and interesting program for tomorrow morning as well. So we thank you. We'll see you here next year, where we expect the aisles will be filled. Thank you to my panelists.
Thank you all.